Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. Most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Murato.
This is an official RTRFM podcast where we share our weekly edition of Movie Chat as heard on Breakfast with Taylor every Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. on RTRFM 92.1. We cover movie releases, we cover cinema releases, we cover streaming releases, we cover the gamut. We cover really low-budget, intensely focused horror, and then big-budget male dance movies. We
and
cover
I will refuse to cover anything in between that, to be honest with you. I from now here on out, I want to exist on those two fringes, please.
Yes, we need to find a midpoint as well. Hopefully we can combine the two genres and get a haunted Magic Mike movie. Not in the Magic Mike universe. We'll be outside that. It could be kind of like almost like, I don't know. I've never seen... I'm trying to think of like horror movies with dances in it.
Horror movies with dances
That's
in it.
That's a good
topic. Tristan, I can name two off the bat.
Sure.
Suspiria and Suspiria.
Of course. And what about Black Swan? But you know, let's get the male dancers in there. Let's get that focused on. But in this episode, one of the films that we look at has become already a bit of a word of mouth cult hit, and that's the film that you look at, Simon.
Yes, Skinamarink. A very, very, very low-budget film that has become a cult hit, but also a polarizing one. So in the second half of this episode, you'll hear me describe it to Taylor, who sounds increasingly terrified as we go on. But Tristan, we start light, right? We start with the third installment of a similarly polarizing film series that really shouldn't be polarizing. Well, you take us through Magic Mike's Last Dance.
Yes, Channing Tatum returns as Mike, the stripper and dancer, for, with that title, what promises to be his last turn. But it's also received a bit of divisive reviews and reaction. But yeah, we get stuck into what exactly is Magic Mike's Last Dance.
What did you want before Miami?
I just wanted to escape my life. I need you. Do you like bartending?
It's not really what I do.
What is it that you really do? But then you came along and gave me this unexpected, magical moment that made me remember who I really was. Come with me to London.
Are you in London?
I'm gonna put on a show at this famous theater.
People are numb, disconnected. We're gonna wake them up with a wave of passion they've never felt before.
Hell yeah. It is 7:30 on your Friday morning. It is time to check in with the squad. It's Movie Squad. Tristan, good morning.
Hello.
Simon, how are you doing?
I'm doing so well. How are you?
Doing very well. Very excited. Movie Squad is back for another week. There is no time to waste, Tristan. We are oiling ourselves up and getting ready to slip into the cinema for Magic Mike's Last Dance.
That's right. What an introduction. It's worthy of Matthew McConaughey's work in the first Magic Mike, where he was the MC and the hype man for the dancers.
That's my career post-RTR, Tristan.
Yeah.
You know?
I think, yeah, good.
I would love to hear Taylor's rendition of Ladies of Tampa.
Ladies of Tampa? No.
So, yeah, the third in the Magic Mike series, which stars Channing Tatum as the stripper dancer Mike. And the first film was directed by Steven Soderbergh and apparently based somewhat on Tatum's own experiences as an up-and-coming dancer in the early part of his career back in Florida. And then that was followed by Magic Mike XXL, which Soderbergh produced but did not direct. And now we have the third film, and it seems to be the last that Channing Tatum will be involved in, though I've heard some reports that they'll be expanding the Magic Mike universe by focusing on some of the supporting characters. Who knows? But
The MMXXLCU. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. But Simon, what, you know, are you a fan of the Magic Mike series? Have you seen the first two films?
Yeah, absolutely. The first one I really liked, even though it had a bit of a polarizing response because people wanted it to be, you know, party movie, dance movie, strip movie. And it was a bit of a post-GFC kind of commentary, as Steven Soderbergh loves to do. But I really liked and responded to that film. And then XXL was the party movie. And that was great too. Mm. And the cast is so good. Joe Manganiello, so fun in that film. Jada Pinkett Smith was excellent as well. Yeah. Robbed of an Oscar nomination, I think, that year. And I'm not even joking. So I've been really keen to, and I haven't seen Last Dance, but I am really keen for this third installment because, by all reports, it's heavily influenced by the stage show, which has also received rave reviews.
Yeah. And Taylor, I mean, with that introduction, you seem a bit more steeped in the lore of the magic, the MXXLCU.
We got to drop that. yes, I've seen both these films. I thought that the first one was it made low budget, or am I just thinking
it
that?
It was, and it was shot on...
Shot on
digital camera, and there was a lot of imperfections in the film, which Soderbergh was playing around with at the time.
Sure. I loved it. He makes all this like poxy furniture in the first one.
Yes.
I'll say it. And it's like kind of bad that it's good.
Mm.
But yes, I have seen both these films, and I, before even getting into your review, Tristan, I have been locked in to see the third film.
Ah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's out in cinemas this week, just in time for Valentine's Day next week. But Soderbergh returns to the director's chair, and, you know, Simon mentions the stage show. That does seem to be something that's incorporated into the plot of the movie. And I think it will, I mean, it's already, in terms of the critical response, divide, I think, people, because what Simon was talking about with the second one, Magic Mike XXL, which has become, I think, a beloved favorite, particularly in film circles, as a kind of just a fun, almost like a musical, but about dancing, it drops some of what made that movie really fun, such as the supporting characters, who really only show up as in a kind of cameo, and then changes the location from like a road movie in America to London. So basically the whole idea is that in the wake of the kind of COVID pandemic, Mike's furniture business has taken another hit, so we see him at the start of the movie back to, well, not stripping and dancing, but working gigs like bartending at rich people's parties. And that's where he meets a wealthy socialite, Maxandra Mendoza, played by Salma Hayek Pinault, who is kind of going through a divorce. She's organized a big event to raise money for a noble cause, but is also kind of in a low point in her life, and hears about Mike's talents as a dancer and offers him some money to have a private session, and one thing leads to another, and they're kind of a little bit involved, but it sort of takes a turn that Mike does not expect, where she says, "I want you to come onto a plane with me to London, where my house is and my adopted daughter, and I want you to direct the stage show." That one of the properties or businesses that she's overseeing in the wake of a divorce from a media mogul is this theater, the Radisson in London, and what's been playing there has been this kind of like costume drama that's been very popular, and audiences keep flocking to it. But she wants to throw that out and put on a show that would give other people the feeling that she felt with the dance that she received from Mike. So the idea is to turn what was kind of like a boring, stuffy stage drama into something that would be like the Magic Mike stage show. And so it's about conscripting dancers off the street, kind of getting a whole new crew. And then also there's a little bit of the heist flavor in terms of that they get a lot of obstacles thrown in their wake that they have to overcome through kind of, a few little...
through dancing?
Yeah, through dancing.
Gyrating.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yes.
But in montages that feel like Soderbergh's work in the Ocean's 11 trilogy. So, yeah, this movie does change things, and it puts a lot more focus on the rom-com or relationship drama between Channing Tatum and Salma Hayek-Pinault, in that they kind of had this creative relationship. They've decided, well, she has set the ground rule that they won't get involved again, that they're focused on the show. But yeah, there's a lot of kind of tension there. And look, I don't know if the chemistry is quite strong between them, but I do like the space that's been given to Salma Hayek-Pinault to really create a fun presence and personality, who is really like looking to be independent, to follow her own desires and to have something of her own. And I really liked her performance in this. I like their, if it's not strong electric chemistry, there's a nice low-key energy that feels appropriate to a lot of Steven Soderbergh films of the past. In fact, this reminded me a lot of, you know, what Simon was talking about, some of those kind of his films that are focused on transactional relationships, like The Girlfriend Experience, Let Them All Talk. I don't know if there's any, that other come to mind, Simon.
They're kind of all about transactional relationships to a degree, but yeah, he it's interesting, though, because he has been, I think, very hit and miss in the most recent couple of years. I wasn't a fan of The Laundromat,
right.
If anyone has even seen that one. And Let Them All Talk, I didn't catch. But, yeah, he definitely has, you know, things on his mind that he and Channing Tatum tell through the Magic Mike series. But, again, Taylor, you know, you're locked in to see this film. Is what Tristan's describing what your co-conspirators are looking for in a Magic Mike movie?
I can tell you based on the text message that I just got that says, Simon, people totally watch Magic Mike just for the intellectual content.
Yes.
That was a vein of sarcasm. I have a feeling they're going to be slightly disappointed.
Yeah.
However, I think this still sounds like an interesting film.
Well, yeah, I might be in the minority here, but I like the film. I really enjoyed it, and more because it was in line with those other kind of... it's really well shot as well. The cinematographer is Peter Andrews, which is like Steven Soderbergh. That's just like a fake name that he uses. So it looks really good. I like the performances. And yeah, even though there are stretches where it does feel like it's doing something different, that it's more about this kind of relationship drama, it all builds up to the third act, the big show, and so you do get the dancing that you, I think, fans want from this. And even though it does seem like Tatum is kind of stepping back a little bit, maybe age is catching up with him, I'm not sure, but I think the climactic dance in particular is very good. So look, I liked Magic Mike's Last Dance. I think it'll really split and divide audiences, maybe not as much as like Ocean's 12 might do for Soderbergh heads out there. But yeah, I liked it, and there is enough, I think, of what people want from the series, even though it might not reach the heights of XXL.
Question.
Yes.
Is there a montage in the film where the ragtag crew of dancers get together and learn the routines?
In a way, yes.
Okay.
In a way.
In a way.
Yeah.
That's all I need to know.
Yeah.
Let us know if you're off to see this. If this is your Valentine's Day date, let us know. 0405-921-921. It's Magic Mike's Last Dance on Movie Squad this morning. Before we jump into our next film of the week, a very quick review here of something opening at the Lottery West film season next week. We're talking 7 Days.
Yes, this is a new film that's already kind of time-stamped because it is a movie about the COVID-19 outbreak, but it's a rom-com set within those parameters. And it stars two very, very funny actors who people will know from supporting roles here and there, but certainly from the TV show Miracle Workers, where they're two of the leads. And that's a very funny show if you've never seen it before. But it stars Geraldine Viswanathan, who's actually an Australian actor, and Karan Soni. And they play two young Indian Americans who are set up on a prearranged date with their parents. You know, they're trying to arrange a marriage for their kids. And they have a very friendly, cordial date. He's sort of very dorky and very marriage-minded. She's very polite. But then through contrivance, wouldn't you know it, COVID, the outbreak has already occurred. They're going on a socially distanced date. But something requires them to isolate in a house for 7 days. And the rom-com is effectively what happens when the veneer of the first date peels away and they discover their true selves. And maybe they're not quite the fit that he was certainly hoping for. But Tristan, maybe it's something better. It is an interesting choice for the Perth Festival. It's a very conventional rom-com, totally lovely, very small scale, obviously, just these two actors. And again, the parameters of COVID-19, I don't know how you two feel now when you watch a TV show or a movie that is sort of built on that. We discussed a lot a couple of years ago, like that lockdown movie with Anne Hathaway.
Not a good one.
Yeah. Some of them very ingenious ways to utilize the, you know, the horrible pandemic. But I don't know how you feel now in 2023 when you see like characters, oh, how do we kiss with masks on? All that kind of stuff.
I don't think I've given much thought to it because I've not really consumed much. I feel like I've moved past that and I don't know. It sounds like this film obviously hasn't. Tristan, what about you?
Well, I mean, with Glass Onion when it started off and it kind of dispensed with that, but the jokes around it did feel, yeah, like from another time, even though it was like a year ago and it's, you know, still something that's affecting the world and us all. But yeah, I mean, it sounds like just kind of a setup for, you know, these two likable performers to kind of, you know, have that sort of, you know, meet cute locked room situation. So yeah, I'm hoping this is much better than Lockdown, which I did not like.
Yeah, and I can pretty much guarantee that without having seen Lockdown. What I will say is that it was filmed in 2021, you know, so it's not, we can't blame it for the fact that it's just taken a while to get to Australia. And I was fortunate enough, I actually saw it fairly early last year. So I am glad it's getting a release, primarily because those two actors are great. They're really funny. I think they are, you know, greater than the film, you know, the sum of its parts, effectively. But they're really fun to watch. And it's a great calling card that they should get hired for more rom-coms and more movies in the future. So 7 days, a totally lovely piece of history that you can catch at the Lottery West Perth Festival next week.
Yeah, opens on Monday, showing through till Sunday for 7 days. Shouldn't be too hard to remember. All right, second film this week, Simon. Please do tell us all about Skinamarink.
In this house. In this house. In this house.
Skinamarink is a new horror film that was released to Shudder last week. You can also access it on AMC Plus, which is a streaming service, if you can believe that. Also available in Australia. Interesting story behind this movie. It was basically leaked online last year. $15,000 movie, very, very small film. Comes from writer and director Kyle Edward Ball, who made a bunch of short films on YouTube basically canvassing commenters on YouTube for their nightmares. And he would adapt their nightmares into these short films. One of them became the formation of Skinamarink. But then the film leaks. Oh no, what are we going to do? Turns out that by leaking, it became a viral hit. Lots of people on TikTok and social media saying, this is the scariest film ever, blah, blah, blah. And it has since been released in America just a couple of months ago and has made millions of dollars. And now arrives in Australia with a wave of hype behind it, which is quite interesting because it is still like a $15,000 movie. I mean, this is cheaper than the first Paranormal Activity, if you remember that moment. Tristan, I'm curious, before we get into the meat of the movie, Taylor, I'm assuming you haven't heard of Skinamarink prior to 4 seconds ago. but Tristan, you know, what kind of expectations have you had or familiarity did you have with it?
Yeah, because it's something that I heard about, like word of mouth, and particularly with a kind of a title like that where you're sort of going, what does this mean? But it seems to have really divided audiences. I think sometimes that hype can work for and against a movie. And a lot of comparisons, even though it's not a found footage movie, but to the original Blair Witch Project. I remember when I saw the Blair Witch Project, and at the end of it, I was still so like tense and just petrified of what I just saw. And then like a couple of seconds later, someone behind me goes, well, that was it? Like, you know, and that, I think those are the two reactions that this film possibly will get. But yeah, I was, the word of mouth had spread about it. Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Blair Witch Project, by the way, still Absolutely terrifying. Absolutely horrifying movie. I fall into that camp, which means I'm probably more inclined to like a movie such as Skinamarink. I think it's, you know, I'll give you the premise here, but it doesn't count for a lot, and I'll explain why in a bit. But ultimately, this film, shot in Kyle Edward Ball's childhood home, again, $15,000 movie, it involves two kids, a six-year-old boy and a four-year-old girl. We overhear their dad on the phone saying that the boy had an accident. He fell down some stairs. Seems to be okay now. The kids can't sleep. They climb out of bed, go downstairs, and start watching some very creepy public domain cartoons on TV. Dad's not in the house anymore. And Mum, something's happened to Mum. And we're not even really sure if she's in the house. But the kids seem to be fending for themselves in this home where something else resides. Something that's calling for them to come upstairs. And meanwhile, the doors and the windows of the house are slowly disappearing. And it's never quite clear if this is all taking place over one night, several nights, or several years. And we kind of have to watch as the kids are tempted by some kind of entity, perhaps, to do some terrible, terrible things. Now, that as a premise is really enticing and exciting, and I promise I'm not trying to overcook what Skinamarink actually is, but it's really important to know going in, this is a film that kind of exists in liminal spaces. We kind of only see things before and after they happen. You know, it's all set between the action, even where the camera is placed. Kyle Ball had a sort of rule that you couldn't show any faces in the movie. So it's all about their backs, their legs, their parts of, you know, feet, like just things that aren't clear. There's only one shot of a face in the entire movie, and it's probably the biggest jump scare of the film. And often the camera will focus on the corners of hallways. Like, you're really not getting a full glimpse at anything throughout the film. It's shot on extremely grainy video that has been, you know, the graininess has been amped up in post-production. The audio has all been recorded in post-production, so you have to really turn it up to make out what the kids are saying, when they're saying anything at all. And this is horror on hard mode, okay? And I say that with love. That's not a question of, oh, you have to be really smart to enjoy this film, or you have to have real taste. I'm just saying this is a movie you have to lock into and pay close attention to get anything out of it. Taylor, is that what you want from a horror film?
This sounds bloody terrifying. I'm intrigued, though, more than I probably would be if it were just a normal run-of-the-mill horror film. I'm curious as to how it all kind of works and fits together based on what you've just described.
Yeah, look, I really liked it. It's not a film that I was captivated by in the sense of, you know, I wasn't gripping the armrests because of the tension, but it is a very disturbing film. And when it does build, and there are absolutely, you know, three or four moments that are like, whoa, this is very upsetting, you know, very horrifying moments. The film did pay off, and I think it definitely lingered with me after watching as well, which I think is important when you make a movie that is like an art installation in many ways. You know, it's sort of, it's experimenting with a camera. It's camera tricks. But it did work for me. Tristan, how did you find Skinamarink?
I was a bit mixed on it, but I think it's also like that. You talking about being locked in. I don't think I was as locked in as I should have been. This would be great to watch in a cinema, but I think it also pays off if you're watching it on a laptop late at night, because there was this eeriness from it, because it is focusing on hallways, on this kind of idea of waking up in the middle of the night and kind of, you know, what's scarier than a dark room? Well, a room that's barely lit, you know, and that kind of just searching in the darkness for a shape. So it was eerie. It is effective, but it also, I guess, because it doesn't focus on any faces, it really tested my patience as well. Yeah. And it's not like a traditional where you feel like you get a connection with the characters. They almost feel very abstract in a way. So I think I would have liked it more if it was a bit shorter, and I think that will test some people. But I respected its vision, and it really goes for the kind of, it's almost like the, I don't know, the opening scene to Poltergeist, but even just like pushing aside anything that just like taking in the corner of a room by a lit television, it can be just as eerie as like the special effects of a monster. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a good test for how well you'll enjoy Skinamarink is to like turn off all the lights around you and then stare at the corner of your ceiling and see if that frightens you.
Yeah.
And but what I do like about this is, you know, Carbold knows what he's doing, and he's spoken about how there are, yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. He's trying to make you search in the absolute darkness through the imperfections of the video. And he notes that, like, yeah, cast and crew, or crew certainly, were placed in certain positions, like just within the camera frame, so that at the last moment you might go, wait, is that a body? And then we move to the next thing. And so I agree. A cinema would have been the ideal way to see this. Obviously, we don't have that opportunity here in Australia. But funnily enough, I think the next best way to consume it is on your phone or the laptop, because I think you actually need that second device occupied, because that allows you to lock into it, as opposed to going, all right, nothing's really going on here. Let me update Instagram, or, you know, check what's on Facebook, or what have you, or read about the film. You kind of need to be... yeah, in bed with the screen 4 inches from your face.
How long is this film?
It was about an hour and a half. Was it longer than that? Or maybe it was several weeks.
Yeah.
It's somewhere between that, an hour and a half and several weeks. But again, I know there's a lot of listeners out there going like, I'm never watching this. But for those who are like, all right, I want to, you know, I enjoy the early works of, you know, David Lynch, or, you know, the really abstract kind of creepy pasta movies we're getting a lot of these days. That's the sort of very internet language version of horror. Even last year's We're All Going to the World's Fair, that was my number 3 film of the year. That's like bloody Fablemans compared to this. But nonetheless, it exists in this kind of world of the internet language that we're becoming more accustomed to. So, really interesting experimental horror film.
All right, Skinamarink is on Shudder. It's a streaming service for horror things. And Magic Mike's Last Dance in cinemas this week. Two different types of a horror film, depending on who you ask. That is Movie Squad. Tristan, thank you.
Thank you.
Simon, thank you.
Thank you.
Movie Squad back on your radio next Friday. And you can always catch up with the podcast wherever you get yours from, and over at the RTR website too.
So there we have it. Two movie reviews in this podcast, served up to you by the master chefs, Tristan, Simon and Taylor. But yeah, really, really great to talk about. Two films that I guess have, in different ways, have a bit of a mixed response. But sometimes it's all about, you know, seeing where you fall in the kind of range. And particularly, yeah, something like Skinamarink, I feel like I should have given it more attention. I think I was kind of rushing to complete it in order to talk about it, but I think I probably shortchanged it in that way, because it is a film that is about, I mean, it tests patience, but you need to give it that full attention to kind of, I mean, a lot of it is just the kind of the tension and the search for what is in the darkness, what is in the grain, the grain of the image.
It tests patience, but I think it rewards patience. Mm. But the reward is nightmares. So
yes.
So that's up to you if you want that. I'd also say that if you are watching Skinamarink, and I often wouldn't say this, but I think I can, because it is a film that also lives in that space between cinema and like a lost internet video. You know, it's not a found footage movie, but it feels like something that, you know, could exist easily on Reddit. If you're half an hour into it and you're not vibing, you're not on its wavelength, you're not going to get on its wavelength. Don't feel like you have to push through. Like I said, it's not about intelligence. It's not about taste. It's not about, you know, graduating to this level of horror. It's about a different kind of horror. And I know that from within the RTRFM office, I won't name any names, but there is a presenter who gives us stick for looking at so many horror films.
Sure.
But I think there's such a wide spectrum of what horror movies can be and do. And I think about some of our favorites from last year, like Resurrection and Deadstream, and now Skinamarink. You look at those three, and they couldn't have less to do with one another.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think, yeah, Skinamarink, it's a horror film by, you know, the simplest way of describing it, but it is an interesting film experiment as well. And I think that's why I wanted to talk about it this week.
Yeah, and definitely, like, you know, Magic Mike's Last Dance has the promotional push and it's out in cinemas, but yeah, definitely in Perth, Skinamarink did not get a chance to be seen in the cinemas, but but, you know, it still works in its own way, watching it on a laptop or a phone, as you say. So, you know, it's always good to put attention on the ones that don't get the big promotional budget or, you know, in that way. But, yeah, it's always great talking movies with you and Taylor, and I look forward to Taylor's review of Magic Mike's Last Dance when we catch up. But, yeah, Steven Soderbergh remains to me an interesting figure in that it seems, I mean, he retired at a point and then came back. But sometimes it feels like his interest is more in terms of, yeah, kind of experimenting or just doing things with the form rather than maybe his like emotional attachment to the material. Has there been one of his films where you feel like it's interesting almost to the point where someone might not like Skinamarink, like this is interesting, but I didn't like love it, but it was interesting enough for me to remember?
Well, I think a good example of one where it actually worked really well was, I think, Unsane, which was filmed on an iPhone, which sounds very gimmicky and is a gimmick. But that was a movie about this character being stalked on social media and being harassed, you know, through phone calls. And I thought there was this, like, nice underlying idea that, yeah, even the movie made about her is done on a phone.
Yeah.
And I felt like that worked, and I thought the technology had caught up with it. I think Steven Soderbergh has been ahead of the technology, which makes him a pioneer, makes him really well-regarded and respected. It also means there's a lot of films out there of his that I don't like or haven't enjoyed.
Yeah.
I've still never seen Full Frontal, which was how he followed up Traffic and Aaron Brockovich. And that was a real experimental mini DV digital movie that apparently just looked god awful. And they, I remember he made all the actors do their own makeup. And so suddenly you've got all these superstars in high definition with very bad makeup. So I think the world just wasn't ready to see David Hyde Pierce that way.
No. I have seen it. I can't, it's because it was touted as sort of his return to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, that, you know, his first big film. But not great. Very interesting in that, like, he just kind of throws everything in there. Like, Terrence Stamp returns as the Limey just for a scene at one point, but then it's really about all these kind of LA types having kind of, you know, sort of navel gazing in a way. But I like even the ones that I don't like, I wasn't a fan of The Good German, but, you know, that was kind of based on the idea of making a 1940s kind of wartime thriller, but with like swearing and sex and violence that you would have nowadays. Or The Informant, which was kind of like this, I guess, a portrait into a person's mind, thinking of themselves as a secret agent when they were really kind of a bit of a fool.
Which is a film I went back to and preferred like 10 years later.
I should revisit it. The one I will shout out because I just watched it last year, and that has a similar meet cute to Magic Mike's Last Dance, is the HBO series that Soderbergh did a while back called Mosaic with Sharon Stone, which when it came out was, I never followed this or saw this, but apparently it was like you download an app, you would watch clips or versions of it and kind of research the clues, almost like you were a detective solving this mystery.
And you could watch any episode in any order, is that
right,
correct?
Right, yeah. But the one that's available now to watch on binge, like, has been edited to an order. But, I really, really enjoyed that. And particularly, yeah, he brings in his, you know, usual collaborators, Cliff Martinez or someone like that doing the score, or David Holmes. Him doing the camera work is always kind of going to make things look visual and stylish and interesting. So I'd recommend Mosaic as well if you're subscribing to Binge.
See, look, we're covering this. I've now found the niche of this week's episode. It's people at the forefront.
Yes.
These guys, these filmmakers, they're on the front lines. They're paving the way. Mm. Maybe these films aren't the ones you want to see, but it's everyone behind them. They're the ones you're going to want to keep an eye on.
That's right. So, yeah, always look to us for the great movie advice and checking out the pioneers of the form. So, yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for listening. Please rate, review, share, subscribe. Do what you can to spread the word, particularly if you know people who like to hear quality movie chat.